And I want to welcome Julian David Stone to Upcoming Dis. Julian Stone, he is the author of a wonderful book. It's called It's Alive. It takes you back to the days, to literally days preceding the production of Frankenstein, the 1931 Universal film with Boris Karloff and Colin Clive. And I got to tell you, this is a time period and a genre that I love. I've always been enamored by these films. I used to work security at a lot of these conventions, so I got to spend a lot of time with Bela Jr. and with Sarah and even Ron Chaney. And I'm really, so I was looking forward to reading this. It's a quick read. It's a wonderful read. And so I want to welcome you to Upcoming Dis. How are you doing there, Julian?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it's one, and Julia's joining me here on Memorial Day, so thank you so much for giving up some of your holiday time to talk to our listeners here.
My pleasure. Again, thanks for having me on.
Well, the book, when you read the book, it kind of gets deep into the thought processes and psyche of Carl Emley Jr., of course, the son of Senior, who established and created Universal Studios, and his kind of fight to you know, set his own pace, and these horror movies were kind of his way to put his own mark on things and what he thought bring the studio into the current, you know, current talkies, which was a big start at the time. So even though you're fictionalizing this and this is a novel, I have to ask, you must have done some kind of research, something you must have done to figure out what some of those thoughts and conversations might have been. Can you tell me how that started?
Sure. I did a ton of research.
I'm sure.
I became very enamored, you know, with the films, and then particularly when I discovered Carl Lemley Jr., or Junior Lemley as he was known.
Right.
Was the notion that this person, Junior Lemley, was put in charge of Universal Studios at the age of 21.
Right.
And started making the horror films when he was the ripe old age of 23.
Mm-hmm.
And I just searched for everything I could possibly find on him. I read interviews with him, accounts from the time period, the trades, everything, just sort of to get the notion of who he was and what he was trying to do with the studio. And he said all this stuff in interviews that, you know, what was so fascinating about him compared, besides his young age, so many of the other studio heads of that era, as would be expected, were considerably older than him.
Right.
He was such a product of the 20s. When you read interviews with him, he kind of talked in 20s lingo. And the first project he made before he got put in charge of the studio, when I think he was all of 18, maybe even have been 17, he made this serial that was very popular in the late 20s about college life.
Right.
And college, you know, the whole world of college football and everything was huge in the 20s. That's where you sort of see the cliche of, like, 20s, for lack of a better term, hipsters with the full-length fur coats. And,
right.
You know, all that sort of thing very much was something that he was enamored of, and that's kind of what I tried to instill in him in a character. That's what really stood out to me, of how much he was a product of the 20s.
And you really brought out the dynamic between him and his father, because, of course, as the book starts, his father's coming out to celebrate his 25th anniversary, and he thinks and hopes that it's to promote him to an official vice president position. And you really get into that, to the dichotomy between them, and him trying to kind of get out from his dad's shadow a little bit, him also trying to you know, bring the studio forward. And so did you see anything? Is there a lot of stuff out there with the two of them where you got to witness that dynamic at all?
Again, it was part of the research thing, and so much of researching Junior Lemley on its own was such a fascinating detective story, because in a lot of ways, and that was kind of part of the reason, one of the things driving me, is that I feel like he's been kind of forgotten, you know, through time, was finding information on them, and some of it is from documents of the time, you know, interviews.
Right.
And a lot of it came from accounts of other people. You know, it would be fascinating. I would often have to read an entire book on somebody's career in Hollywood to find one or two paragraphs where the Lemleys come in. But that's where you found out, or where I found out, a lot of interesting information about the conflict between the two of them. And there were a fair amount of stories in other people's accounts who worked for them.
Yeah, and not to say that the book completely is you know, dominated by Carl Emley Jr. or Senior, but you also go very deeply into both Bela Lugosi, who was originally planned for the monster and turned it down and played this little back and forth game with Universal, and then also Boris Karloff, who was kind of still an upcomer, even though he was in his 40s, I guess, at the time. And I love that you showed such a difference in them. But Karloff being the guy who's hungry, he's, you know, working for every day he can, whereas Lugosi's at a spot now where, you know, he's looking for respect, he's looking for some kind of notice for what he's doing. And I love the part that you continually counter on to highlight the differences of how Karloff can't understand how wonderful it must be to be able to turn down work.
Right. Well, that was, you know, the three main characters of the book are, like we've already talked about, Junior Lemley, Boris Karloff, and Bela Lugosi, and that was the other thing that sort of really inspired the story, is that all three of them come out of this experience of Frankenstein.
Right.
It changes their entire lives, and particularly Lugosi and Karloff go in two very different trajectories.
Exactly.
Karloff obviously becomes a big star and never stops being a star, and Lugosi, through the 30s, continued to work in pretty good movies, but he was never the same as he was after Dracula. The period immediately after Dracula was the height of his career, and then, you know, as we all know, people that are fans of the monster movies, there's kind of a slow decline where by the 40s and 50s, he's not in the best of films, unfortunately.
Right. That's very true. And Frankenstein changed things for not only those two actors, it changed things for the studio, of course, because as much as people talk about, you know, this might have been some kind of subgenre, the horror cycle actually saved Universal.
Oh, absolutely, particularly in this period of time, it was among their most successful films. The Lemleys run the studio up until 1936, and all of the horror films that were made during Junior's tenure as head of production were big hits.
They were. They were indeed. And for those of you out in the audience who aren't necessarily horror films, I have to tell you that one of the interesting things that you spend a good bit of time on is documenting that transition that was going on at the time between the silence and the talkies. And you spent a bit of time talking about how you know, these theater people were now very sought after because they were used to talking in their work, and these silent people were somehow losing some of their luster, the people who couldn't make the transition. And I think that's a neat part of Hollywood history you're capturing here. So it's not just for the horror fan. It's really for the studio fans. It's for the fans of that transition time.
Right, but that was, I wanted to write a story that was about Hollywood of the period, not just about horror films. And, you know, your first question was about my research.
Right.
That was actually the big turning point for me, because I'd been working on the project for a while, and I had been really focusing on the Universal Monsters, and the story wasn't working, and that's when I had this epiphany that I needed to take a step back, and I needed to really look at Hollywood of that period.
Right.
So I basically tried to watch as many films as I could find from 1930 to 1931, and not just Universal's films, but everybody's films, and I started reading the trades chronologically to see the trends and how sound was coming in, and that's when the story really clicked and when things really started to come together.
And it's really interesting when you hear some of these silent people in there, and one of them makes the comment that they thought that sound was just a passing fad and just wouldn't last long, and they'd get to go back to making their silence. And, you know, looking at that from a much more modern perspective, it seems so naive that anybody could think that, but I guess a lot of them did.
Oh, there's no question. And, you know, the other thing that's really fascinating is when sound came into films, which is sort of really credited, you know, the jazz singer at the end of 1927 is considered the beginning of it. Nobody really knew what a sound film was. There were no rules for, you know, are people going to want to hear dialogue? Maybe they only want sound effects. In music?
Right.
Nobody knew for sure. So if you look at the history of films, it's about 1932, 1933, when if you look at a film from that era, obviously it'll look very old and antiquated, but the relationship of sound is something you find familiar, the way music is used in dialogue and sound effects. But up until then, there's some fascinating hybrids where some films were made with just sound effects, not dialogue. You know, they're still trying to figure out what exactly a sound film is going to be, and that's why some people thought it would just be a fad. And, you know, just to give you, just from, you know, our history of, depending on how old your listeners are, how old you are, there have been some technologies that did not catch on. You know, remember Sensoround? I don't know if anybody remembers that one.
So, oh, I do. Earthquake and Roller Coaster.
Yeah. Right, and that didn't catch on. So it's not a foregone conclusion that just because they can, you know, they can do something different, that necessarily it's going to stick around. And even 3D, which has had, you know,
it comes and goes.
Disappeared. You're right, it comes and goes, and right now it's not as big as it was even, say, 7 or 8 years ago.
No, it's not.
So it's really
Yeah. I have to tell you, I love at the end when you show, you end the film like 100 some days after the production or such, and a premiere of the of Frankenstein. And, you know, I love that because I was friends with Forrey Ackerman. I don't know if you know who he was. I assume you do.
Oh, I do, yes.
Yeah, well, Forrey and I were friends, and he used to love to tell that story about when he saw Frankenstein as a young man, and the nurse would come and people would scream and, right. and come out, and they'd have the ambulance parked in front of the theater and stuff. So that kind of reminded me of Forrey a little bit. And much of this book did as well, because these are the kind of stories that he used to tell when I used to hang with him. And I miss him a lot. He was a great man.
I was fortunate enough to visit his home one time during when he would have those sort of open houses occasionally, and I did get to go one time, and I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, I was lucky when the time I did get to see him, I was out there. He wasn't doing that, but he graciously let me come in and showed me around. So I ended up getting a private tour, which was a lot of fun. I have tons of pictures from it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he was a great guy. So now let me ask you a question. Since this novel does take place with these three really central people who are quite known, at least the actors are. Have you gotten any feedback from like Bela Jr. or Sarah Karloff?
Well, that's very funny you should ask that. I reached out. I had seen Sarah at conventions and had talked with her a little bit. You know, nothing that she would remember.
She's great though.
She's very, very sweet. So again, I have no personal relationship with her, but I did have my publicist reach out.
Yeah.
And she was very receptive, and I sent a book, and she wrote me an absolutely wonderful, after reading it, letter, which I got about 2 weeks ago, which I just cherish, where she said she thoroughly enjoyed the book and thanked me for, you know, sort of keeping her father's legacy going, and then also gave permission for a quote that we can use for our publicity. I got that through my publicist, in fact,
great.
A few days ago. So I've had that reaction. I haven't had anything with Bela Jr. I didn't talk to him as much at conventions. And again, I don't know Sarah. I'm just saying I have to.
Yeah.
I've spoken with her in the past. Lovely family members have been great. There was a couple who I spoke to while I was writing the book who were very helpful in their thanks and the special thanks. And then since the book has come out, I've had three or four relatives of the Lemleys reach out to me, and that's always been absolutely thrilling because Junior stops, basically the Lemleys, like I said, lose the studio in 1936, and Junior lives over 40 more years, and there's almost nothing on him. He unfortunately passes away just about the time that generation of which I'm part of, who rediscovered the horror films in the 60s and 70s, were starting to write books about it.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, I feel like if he had lived 10 more years, he would have been interviewed over and over again, but unfortunately, he kind of disappeared. So a lot of the relatives who have reached out to me have told me great stories of going to visit him. None of them had any, like, they just referred to him as a relative that they seem to have. They said he never really talked about his days at Universal.
Right.
Some of them talk about holding the Oscar that he won for All Quiet on the Western Front. But that's been really gratifying that everybody so far that I've heard from has been really gracious with their comments. Because these, you know, all three of these characters are heroes to me. You know, I write them as complex human beings,
right.
which will, you know, show them, you know, that they were complex people, but it comes from a place of loving all of them.
And you know what? You could tell that. And you certainly didn't just treat them as just, you know, characters thrown on a page. Particularly, like I said, with Carl Lemley, with Jr., I think that you went way, you know, I really got to feel like I got to know that guy. I mean, the other two I knew more about because, like I said, I've spent time with their kids. I've researched that myself and spent a lot of time in that. But him, not. You know, the closest I got is many years ago when I was doing security, I got to hang out with Carla.
Yeah.
You know, and she was always proud of the old, I spoke the first word in a horror movie, you know, in the beginning of Dracula.
Yep.
So,
wow.
So I really do. I have to give you the credit for that I think you really get deep down. And also, I think, showed the atmosphere of that studio times, because that's something I didn't get in any of the other conversations and such, as I got a feeling like I got to hang out in at Universal Studios in the 30s, and because you gave a good idea when they were driving through. You really described some of the places they're going to. You described some of the places that were important to him, and I like that. So I guess with all that atmosphere, the big question is there any intention to maybe film this?
Oh, that would certainly be wonderful. You know, it's nothing that, I mean, the book is available, the rights are available, and I'm certainly hoping somebody will reach out, but it's nothing that I'm working on personally.
Well, I hope someone does, because I have to tell you, I've been disappointed that there hasn't been a really good film on these days and the making of these films. I mean, Gods and Monsters, I had a lot of hope for, and I really ended up liking that film. It didn't focus where I really wanted the focus to be. And as much as James Whale is a wonderful character and a wonderful person and deserves a lot of credit for what he's been through and such, I really wanted to see the behind the scenes of these films being made. I want to see somebody take me to these places. And I always thought Jeremy Irons, man, I thought, boy, if a guy could play Boris Karloff.
Wow, that's a good choice, because a lot of people, you're not the only person since the book's, been out in the Hollywood Reporter, put it in their, hot books section. So I'm hoping, and that was certainly something I have wanted with it, but that's a lot of people have thrown out their casting ideas, and that's one of the best ones I've written so far. That's really fun.
Oh, he would make a wonderful Karloff.
Yeah.
I think he would. Now, I have another question here is, where you started, was there a reason for that? Is there a reason you didn't maybe even go back to, say, the end of Dracula or something, starting just, I think it was 3 or 4 days before the production of Frankenstein? Was there a reason for that particular start? Because you make a big deal out of where we are in time here.
Yeah, it really just has to do with, as a writer, you want that pressure cooker, you want to keep that story engine going.
Right.
I felt that just really was the moment to start. Because, that is a good question. You're the first person to ask me that directly, and I can't remember if I ever had it any other way. Because it just, what I do remember, just this will get a little deep in sort of the writing process, but
yeah.
when the story came together, which was literally almost at the beginning, when I first went, okay, I've got something here, it was the relationship of the first three sequences, the first Junior, the first Lugosi, and the first Karloff sequence.
Right.
And I think that was built around the sort of pressure cooker aspect.
Okay.
So I hit that pretty early on. I don't have a specific reason, except just as a writer, you're always looking for a big launching point, and days before the beginning of production is always a crazy time.
Right, and I got the impression it was a very important part of the narrative to you, because you kind of really build that idea of where we are in this days to go thing right from the beginning. I mean, it's thrown into your head before even the story is.
Yeah, well, it's based on, the book is historical fiction.
Right.
If you look at the very beginning of it, there's three quotes in a row. Those are all real quotes from
newspapers
of the time.
Yeah.
And the one that sort of led me to wanting to compress the time period is that famous letter that Colin Clive received when he arrived from England.
Right.
That was waiting for him in New York, and I believe it was with a copy of the script, where it's just a couple of weeks from production that here's James Whale writing him saying that the part of the monster will be played either by Bela Lugosi or Boris Karloff.
Right.
So it was very clear that right up to the last minute, they were still trying to figure this out. And if anybody's worked in film, it is so common that way. It may sound crazy, but relatively large roles will often get cast just a couple of days before a film will start shooting.
Sure.
It's the way the business is. If somebody falls out, you got to find somebody else.
Yeah, that's true. And you know what? There's a character that we don't get to go inside too much anywhere, and that is Colin Clive, because fortunately he didn't live very long after that, so he didn't have a long movie career. But he's a character I would love to know more about than I've been able to find out about.
Yeah, when you read accounts with him, different people's opinions of him, he seemed to have sadly have been a very troubled soul.
Yeah,
that led to his early death, and there was alcoholism, and he
right.
Boy, what a performance! I mean, it's
absolutely.
So much of Frankenstein, obviously the biggest thing being it's impossible to imagine the film without Karloff as the monster, but my God, I can't imagine anybody else playing, Dr. Frankenstein, and particularly, the most famous moment when the monster is
right.
alive, and when you read the script and, the words "it's alive" are only mentioned twice in the script, and he does it 7 times
yeah.
in that amazing scene. It's just so wonderful.
It's iconic. And then I guess the last question is, at the end of the book, you tease a little bit. Someone throws out the idea of Bride of Frankenstein. Well, at least that's what you're teasing us at. You don't come out and say that, of course. But you're teasing us a little bit with Bride of Frankenstein. Is there a sequel in the works?
I can't say I have one in the works, but I would certainly, if the opportunity arose, I would love to revisit these characters and go further with them. There's definitely a lot of great material following all of them through the rest of the decade.
Yeah, there certainly is. And boy, Bride of Frankenstein, what an eclectic mix of people that went into creating that, the actors and such. It's a treasure trove of stuff, and I'm hoping that you maybe pick it up, because I enjoyed this. This is a quick read, I'll tell people. It's a very good read. It's fast. You don't muddle down anything. You go through it quickly, but you'll love it. I can highly recommend it. It was a book from somebody who loves this era. I mean, I grew up with my dad. We would watch the creature features, and that was my first introduction to these, on the Friday, Saturday night back in the early 70s, late 60s, watching these old Universal films. And so I've been in love with them ever since, and you can tell the love in this book. So how can people reach you if they want to find out more about other work you're doing beyond this book? How can they find you?
Sure. I can be reached at juliandavidstone.com. That's where you can read more about this novel, It's Alive. You can actually download the first chapter of the book for free at my website. So if people are
good deal.
Curious, that you can read the first chapter and then decide from there. But I think anybody who picks it up who particularly is interested in old Hollywood in the 30s and also the monster movies, I think they'll enjoy it. As you said, that was kind of my goal, to make it entertaining, but also talk about this fascinating moment in time and really the birth of a genre. It's really the beginning of horror that is still obviously very popular until today.
It certainly is. And when you look at the number of directors and writers and even actors today who talk about being inspired by these works, makeup artists. I mean, Jack Pierce, my God.
Yeah,
and I love the little, he didn't spend a lot of time with him, but I love the little bit of time we spend with Jack Pierce and Boris and him talking about, his method, which was, I thought was interesting, and Karloff's perspective of the change when he was actually doing it for real.
Right. Well, that was kind of part of the fanboy in me, is that I want to be in that makeup room with them while they're creating, so I'm like, okay, I'll write a scene about it. That's the way you get to sort of live and put your love out there of these films. Is that, I mean, all of us would have loved to have spent one day in there watching this amazing makeup put on, and you get to do that as a writer, you get to imagine that.
You're absolutely right. So, well, I got to tell you, I want to thank you for spending part of your Memorial Day with us. I think that anyone who picks up this book who has an interest, like I said, in whether it's just 30s or 40s Hollywood, whether it's people who are interested in that transition from talkies, obviously the Universal horror cycle stuff, this is gonna make you happy. It's gonna be a quick read. In fact, it's gonna be a too quick read. Honestly, when I was done, I'm like, oh man, I'm done.
Leave them wanting more.
Well, you did that, and I'm hoping maybe we'll plant a seed of taking this further, because I would like to see where else you can go with this. I think there's a rich group of material there, and you're the kind of writer, I think, that will give it justice.
Well, thank you. It would be my pleasure and honor to do that. So we'll see.
Well, we appreciate you joining us here.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.